is supersymmetric vector multiplets, non-abelian supersymmetric vector multiplets, and actually start talking about quantum non-abelian gauge theories. So let's go back and recall what we discussed yesterday, last time. So we talked about G and non-abelian, a non-abelian group. And so what we looked at at the chiral fields, chiral superfields, and anti-chiral, which are charged under this group. So they transform in some representation. And so we introduced a gauge parameter. So gauge parameter in this case takes this form where T sub A are generators. Generators of Lie algebra, right? So we have a commutator of TA, TB equals IFABC TC, where FABC are structure constants of our Lie algebra, and they are the ones that specify which group we are talking about. Now, then what we did, we proceeded exactly in the same way how we gauged global symmetries in the abelian case. Okay, so we can think of that we start looking at the simplest possible Keller potential of this type, and we can assume. So, for example, for concreteness, we will talk that in our case G is a unitary group SUN, and so we can think of that our superfields transform in some representation, right? So phi transforms transforms in R of SUN, and then phi bar, a complex conjugate of this field, will transform in R bar representation of SUN. And so the Keller potential, as it's written, is invariant under global SUN transformations. And so what we have to do, we have to gauge global transformations. And we do it in exactly the same way how we did for U1 symmetry. So we just say that our field phi transforms into minus I lambda phi, right? So where lambda is a chiral superfield. So once we gauge it, we allow our gauge parameter to depend on spatial coordinates. And once we go to superfield, we think about our gauge parameter as being chiral or anti-chiral superfield. So lambda, the function of x, theta and theta bar is a chiral superfield, right? Well, since it's a chiral superfield, it's actually a function of y and theta. And then our phi bar, we have to transform in a conjugate representation, right? So now I have to take care because for a non-abelian group, the generators do not commute. And so the order will matter. So if I take a conjugate of this expression, I will get something like this. And I have to think about lambda bar as being an anti-chiral. Lambda bar is an anti-chiral superfield. So now once we do that, so what we notice that as it stands, we cannot make theory invariant under local transformations, right? Because K is no longer invariant. And the problem is that those two guys are different, right? So there is a mismatch, as you can see, that phi hat phi bar phi will go to phi bar e to the I lambda bar e to the minus I lambda phi. Okay, so and the combination up here is actually non-zero. So the way to remedy this is to, much like we did in the case of abelian symmetries, gauging abelian symmetries, is to introduce additional superfield, a vector superfield. So what we will have a modified Keller potential, a gauged one, where we inserted a vector superfield V. And what we have to claim that under the gauge transformation, our vector superfield transforms as well. And so in particular, the transformation rules of the vector superfield must be such that this term is invariant. So we must go to this. So this tells us that e to the v must go to e to the minus I lambda bar e to the v e to the I lambda. So then what we discussed after that, we actually,
A g value.
Right. So v is a vector. So when I write it like this, so what I mean is that there is a decomposition in terms of generators of Lie algebra in the corresponding representation, right? So v is v sub a, v sub a, where the index a runs over the appropriate representation. And we spent a lot of time yesterday discussing what is a correct representation. But actually, we can figure it out just by looking at the infinitesimal transformations. And that's what we did. But let me mention some more things. First of all, much like in the U1 case, here we can take a Vezzumino gauge. It's possible again. And so in this Vezzumino gauge, what is possible to choose, this is a full chiral superfield, so it has lots of components. So I can tune some of those components in such a way that my vector superfield, the cube of it, would actually vanish, and that would imply that all higher powers will vanish as well. And so then in this Vezzumino gauge, our gauge transformation, chiral superfield lambda, takes this form. So I have alpha plus I theta sigma mu theta bar del mu alpha plus a quarter theta squared theta bar squared box alpha, okay, where alpha is a Lie algebra valued object. And so it decomposes in terms of real parameters, right? So those guys are real. And so then what we did, we actually studied infinitesimal transformations corresponding. So we started up to order alpha squared gauge transformations. And so the finite gauge transformations on a vector superfield is given by this expression. And so what we did an expansion and looked at the small values of alpha. We linearized, actually. And so in this Vezzumino gauge, exactly like in the case of a U1 symmetry, my vector superfield has a lowest component, which is lambda, okay? So lambda will be a wild fermion. This is a Gaugino. So Gaugino. And I will have as many of them as necessary to be in the appropriate representation, right? Then there is a gauge potential. And finally, there are scalars, which are D terms, right? So this is vectors. And then there are D terms. So what we did after we studied this infinitesimal transformations, what we showed that all these objects, they transform in adjoint representation. Of our gauge group G, okay? So what I want to do now, We want to continue. Yep.
Well, so D terms, those are scalars, right? So remember, like in the case of a U1, those were real scalars, but they are non-dynamical. They don't have a kinetic term. So if you ask how many propagating degrees of freedom I have, so this is a wild fermion. So for each wild fermion, I have two propagating degrees of freedom for each index A. And now I have a vector multiplet, right? So a normal vector multiplet, it must be massless. So each gauge boson has also two propagating degrees of freedom. And it has as many indices as our wild fermions. So we also have a balance between bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom. There is a mismatch due to this real scalars D sub A, right? But as I told you, much like in the case of abelian U1 symmetry, those will end up to be non-dynamical, and so.
So if they're non-dynamical, what do they do?
They will just determine, so once we compute in 5-10 minutes the scalar potential, and they will be important whether or not we have a supersymmetric ground state, right? Whether we can make the scalar potential to vanish.
All right, guys. So then the next step, exactly, I'm just going parallel here with the U1, so is to introduce a field strength, introduce a SUSY field strength. And the expression is actually identical to what we have in the case of a U1. Or in other words, I can rewrite a U1 expression in this form. So we will have a field strength superfield, right? So this is field strength superfield. And so it's determined as minus a quarter, and then I have d bar squared e to the minus v, and then I have d alpha e to the v. Okay, where d bar and d alpha are supercovariant derivatives. Okay, so I'm not gonna write down the expansion. So first of all, it's much more tedious than to do in the abelian case. So we more or less discussed it in the abelian case, but the expression is given in Wessenberger. Okay, for what we need, we will actually, I'll just give you the answer, but it's a very straightforward exercise to compute this in the Vezzumino gauge. So one thing is, much like in the U1 case, much like in U1 case, what happens is that W alpha is a chiral superfield, okay? So that's, and it can be proven in exactly the same manner. So what I do want to show to you is that actually that supersymmetric field strengths transform covariantly under finite gauge transformations. So it transforms as appropriate for an object in an adjoint representation. Okay, so this is something that we will show. So let me first remind you, what does it mean to transform in the adjoint representation? Well, so if I talk about non-abelian field theories, I can have a non-abelian field strength. So F mu nu is a non-abelian field strength. So I write it in this way. What I mean, I actually mean this, where T sub A are generators in the adjoint representation. And so if I do, so this is in ordinary, non-abelian H theories. Okay. So if I have a field strength like that, and then U is an element, of my group, right? So I don't care whether it's infinitesimally close to identity or not. So it's some element inside my group. So the statement that F transforms in the adjoint representation means that if I act with this gauge transformation on the field strengths, it will transform covariantly. So it will go to U minus 1 F mu U. Actually, I use different notation, okay, where my U is e to the minus I lambda, right? So this lambda is not a superfield. We're talking about ordinary gauge series. So this is just lambda A of x times Ta. So what we're going to show with you now that maybe I should put a hat, a tilde here or something like that. So what we're going to show here is that the field strength, when we do the expansion, one of the components of that field strength will actually be the non-abelian field strength. And so it better be the case that the whole object W alpha transform covariantly under supersymmetric gauge transformations. So in other words, we want to show so that if I do a supersymmetric gauge transformation, lambda is a SUSY gauge transformation. Okay, then W alpha will transform e to the minus I lambda, W alpha e to the I lambda, where lambda is my full chiral superfield, right? So you can think of as going into the limit of ordinary gauge series by setting all theta parameters to zero, right? So if you do that, in the Vesemino gauge, you can see that lambda equals just a scalar. And so you can think that that scalar is precisely the scalar alpha that we discuss in the context of ordinary non-abelian gauge series. And so what we need to do, we need to prove this statement. And the way how I wrote the supersymmetric field strengths, actually the proof is very simple. So let's go ahead and talk about it. So proof. So W alpha will go, so I know how my vector superfield transforms, right? And I know a definition how the field strength is related to a vector superfield, right? So I will have minus a quarter d bar squared, then I have minus I lambda e to the minus v, right? So I use the fact that e to the v goes to e to the minus I lambda bar e v I lambda. And so if I take an inverse of this, right, so what will happen is that if I take an inverse of the product of matrices, the order will get reversed. So I will have minus I lambda e to the minus v e to the plus I lambda bar. So that's why I have this combination here, e to the plus I lambda bar, right? So that's a transformation of e to the minus v under finite gauge transformation, right? So here I am doing a finite transformation. Alpha is not infinitesimal. And then I have d alpha, and which acts on minus I lambda bar e to the v e to the plus I lambda. Okay, so let's see what happens. So d bar is an anti-covariant derivative, right? So when it acts on a chiral superfield, it will annihilate it. So what I can do, I can simply pull this thing outside. So this will be equal to minus a quarter. I have e to the minus I lambda d bar squared, and then I still have this guy left, e to the I lambda bar, right? Now, for the same reason, lambda bar is anti-chiral superfield. So it will be annihilated by D, which means that I can pull it outside. And then I have D alpha. D alpha acted on e to the V, e to the I lambda. Okay, so those two things will cancel, right? And then I just have to look at D alpha acted on e to the V, e to the V, e to the I lambda, right? So that's very simple. So D has a linear action, right? And so D alpha, e to the V, e to the I lambda. So it's exactly the same. I need to keep. So let me keep this term. Okay. So I'm just going to look at this combination here. So there are two possibilities. There are two possibilities. One, when d alpha acts as a differential operator on e to the v, and the other possibility is when d alpha acts as a differential operator on e to the I lambda. So in the first case, I will have d bar squared e to the minus v d alpha that acts on e to the v, right? And then I have outside e to the I lambda. Okay, so that will be one term. And then there is another term. So d alpha doesn't act on this, but act on e to the I lambda. So I have e to the minus v, e to the v, and I have this term. Okay, so the first term here will be the one that will produce a covariant transformation law, right? And so all we have to do is just to show that this guy is zero. So if we show this, then that would imply the W alpha goes to minus e to the minus I lambda, W alpha e to the I lambda. And so if we restrict, if we set all theta terms to zero, so what that would imply in particular the covariant transformation law on our field strength, right? With my definition for the U. So how can we prove this? Okay, well, this is very simple. So what do I have? I have that this object is d squared, and then I have d alpha e to the I lambda, right? So because e to the minus v will cancel with e to the v. And so I can write this down as minus d to the beta dot d bar beta dot. The minus sign is because I use unconventional contractions, right? And then I have d alpha acted on e to the I lambda. So this is equals to, so this minus d beta dot. So what I can do here, I can use the commutation relation, anti-commutation relation for the antiderivatives. And I can rewrite this as minus d alpha d bar beta dot at the expense of adding plus 2p alpha beta dot, right? So where this guy is just p mu sigma mu alpha beta dot. All right, so and all of this acts on I lambda. Right, so the first term, you can see that it's an anti-chiral derivative, so it will annihilate the chiral superfield. The second term is an identity, and so this chiral superfield will be annihilated by this d bar. So this is an argument that we used before. So what we did, we showed that our supersymmetric field strength transforms covariantly as it must, given that one of its components is a supersymmetric field strength. So so now the question is, how do we write down the supersymmetric Lagrangians? So let's start discussing their vector multiplet. Okay, so we know that W alpha is a chiral superfield, but it carries a left-handed spinor index. So I want to create a combination so that there is no spinor indices left. So I have to contract it. Okay, so this is the same contraction how we did previously. It's still a chiral superfield. However, this object is not invariant under gauge transformations, right? So this object transforms covariantly under gauge transformations. Right, so in the case of a U1, once we make this contraction, then this combination was invariant under U1 gauge transformations. In non-abelian case, it's not. So in fact, W alpha with alpha index will transform as e to the minus I lambda, and then I have W alpha e to the I lambda, e to the minus I lambda. And then I have W alpha e to the plus I lambda. So it's still a chiral, right? So which it better be the case. So I lambdas inside will cancel. And so it will transform e to the minus I lambda, W alpha e to the I lambda. So if you wish, the reason why it was invariant in the abelian case, because in the abelian case, so by the way, what I mean by this W alpha, again, it carries a Lie algebra index, right? So it's actually this object. It's a Lie algebra valued supersymmetric field strength. So before those matrices, so I have to think of them as matrices, right? So before in the abelian case, those were just numbers, and so they were commuting. In this case, I cannot just simply move e to the I lambda and cancel it with e to the minus I lambda. But there is a simple solution to this issue. So all I have to do is just take a trace in some representation. Okay, and once we start talking about quantum gauge theories, we will discuss the issues. How do we actually define this trace more precisely? So what I mentioned last time is that one thing is that we can think that our generators of non-abelian gauge group are normalized in such a way that if I take a trace in the fundamental representation, so it will be trace TATB. This is just 1/2 Kronecker delta AB, right? So if I take a trace, then the stuff inside the trace will still transform covariantly, but then I can use a cyclicity of the trace, and so the trace is actually an invariant thing. So I have a trace W alpha. All right, and yep.
Using the adjoint representation.
W's, yeah, you mean?
Yeah.
They are the adjoint representation.
So then why are you choosing the fundamental?
Sorry?
So you're changing the representation.
Well, you know, in which representation they are, I'm not changing the representation. It's a question, so this index A runs about always the dimensionality of the representation. But I can choose these generators to be in any representation I want.
Yeah.
So I just choose them to be in the fundamental representation. I could as well choose it in the adjoint representation. We'll talk about this later today. That's actually the question, how do I normalize those generators? Because, for example, in the case of SU3, I have 8 gluons, right? But I can write down, if you wish, a QCD field strength as still 3x3 matrices, right? So there will be, so a 3x3 matrix is a generator of SU3 in the fundamental representation. But I can still write down, if you wish, the field strength of the SU3 as, you know, some. So this index A will run from 1 to 8, but each of the generators will be 3x3 matrix. And being a 3x3 matrix, it will act naturally in the fundamental representation. Okay, so that's what I mean here when I wrote that I normalized in such a way.
What does the subscript F mean?
F means fundamental.
Oh.
Right. So in the case, again, coming back to the question that Sean just asked. So in the case of the SU3, I would think of them as 3x3 matrices. So there will be 8 3x3 matrices that I will need to define SU3 field strengths. Right, guys? So. So now once we understand how to build up a chiral superfield from the field strength, which is actually invariant under gauge transformations, so we can construct a supersymmetric Lagrangian, right? So that was a chiral superfield. So what I can do, so Lagrangian, I can take my chiral superfield and integrate over half of the superspace. And so I'm just going to do it in exactly the same way how we did for a U1 case. So I will introduce a complexified coupling, 32 pi I. And then here, the only difference is that now I have to trace in some representation. So the formulas and the particular coefficients that I am writing are in the case when I use my Lie algebra generators in the fundamental representation. So I have W alpha, W alpha. And so this tau is a complexified Young-Mills coupling. It's a coupling of a non-abelian gauge theory. And so, but it takes exactly the same form as before. So, 4 pi over G Young Mills squared I. And then there is a theta angle, much like in the case of a U1. Now, so this was the case. This is a supersymmetric gauge invariant action for non-abelian vector multiply, right? So now if I have chiral superfields, which are charged under my gauge group, I can just write down the most general superpotential here. Well, first of all, I can assume that my coupling tau depend on where in the field space I am as far as chiral superfields are concerned. So think of this that much like in the example we discussed some time ago, whenever I have a coupling, I promote it to a chiral superfield if that coupling is in the superpotential. So this is part of the superpotential. And so it must be gauge invariant. So it must depend on a chiral superfield, but it must depend it in such a manner that it's invariant under gauge transformations. But it's possible in some more complicated theories. Plus, since I have a chiral superfield, I can have a superpotential as a function of phi I. And again, my superpotential better be invariant under gauge transformations. And this is something that Matt was raising and we discussed last time. How do I know that it will be invariant before? And the argument is exactly the same as in a U1 case. So we start with chiral superfield. We assume that there is some global symmetry and we are gauging that global symmetry. So as long as we started with a symmetric
if you wish, Vesumino model with some, or nonlinear sigma model with some symmetry, then we are guaranteed that this W will be invariant under local gauge transformation. So this is a supersymmetric, this is a superpotential, right? So there is plus Hermitian conjugate of it. And then there is a Kala term, right? So the Kala term is object that encodes kinetic terms for our chiral superfields. And so it's an integral over a full superspace, d2 theta, d2 theta bar. And again, this is something that we discussed before. So a Kala potential can be an arbitrary function, and I can make, if I start with a function which had a global non-abelian symmetry, I can make this non-abelian symmetry local by simply introducing e to the v. Okay? So the claim is that that's it. Okay, so this is a a Lagrangian for a supersymmetric generalization of QCD-like theory. So those phis will be our quarks, okay? And so we have a coupling. So if we evaluate these Grassmannian integrals, then we will obtain everywhere covariant derivatives as we must. And in particular, if we do a supersymmetric extension of the standard model, there will be a term like contained in that extension. So one thing that I want to note to you is, remember in a U1, that's it. There is no other term we can write down which is invariant under supersymmetry and invariant under non-abelian gauge transformation. And that's an important fact. For example, in the U1 case, there was one additional term, right? So in U1 case, there was one additional piece that we could write down in a Kala potential, and that was an integral d2 theta bar of 2k v, right? So v as a vector, U1 vector superfield, was invariant under gauge transformations. And so that that led to KD, which was invariant under supersymmetric and gauge transformations. And this is a term which is which we discussed some last time, and this is Pyatelopoulos term, right? In particular, the presence of this term was important to the question, for example, whether or not we have D-term moduli space, or whether or not we have a supersymmetric vector to begin with. So we can ask exactly the same question. Well, is there a Pyatelopoulos term in a non-abelian case? And the answer is no. So in non-abelian case, we cannot Pyatelopoulos term. And the answer for that, is very simple. So naively, I could try to do exactly the same thing, right? And so I can write down it in this way. So I have a superfield, and I integrate over the whole superspace. So this term is actually Susi invariant, right? But this term is not invariant under gauge transformation. And the reason is, so the vector superfield, if I do gauge transformations, will transform into u to the minus one, right? So it's not invariant, it's a covariant. And so the only way I can make it gauge invariant is if I write down a trace here, okay? So that would be the only way to make it Susi invariant plus gauge invariant, okay? Otherwise, it's a covariant without the trace. However, What I have here, so if I look in some details on this object, what I have is that this trace is actually trace VA TA, right? And so I have that this is a VA trace of TA, but the generators of my Lie algebra are traceless. So this term vanishes. Okay, so this is the reason why there cannot be Fayette-Linopoulos terms in non-abelian gauge series.
If you write down the square term, this
it will still transform, right? So it will still transform as v squared.
Not get a D term, but
right. So right. So I cannot see the D squared is already present in E to the D piece.
Right.
So when they do the expansion, and so if we will look at the five, if we look, so it turns out that this one is an additional would be gauge invariant term, but E squared would not be. It's already present in E to the V. It is E to the V object that transforms nicely under gauge transformations. All right, guys. So we're done.
We're done with supersymmetric field series, except that there is one thing that I want to mention, and that's related to Sean's question about the D terms. And so in the last, what I want to do is let's look at scalar potential, right? So. We want to compute scalar potential in our SUSY QCD, meaning that I have a vector multiplet plus chiral. Yes.
Sorry, what if you make K transforming under the
Well, I want to think about K. So K will be a coupling, right?
Yeah, so you argued some time ago that you can have couplings having charges in the global.
Right, but I don't know how to make coupling charge on the local.
Okay.
Because my local symmetry will be broke. Is that the same?
Okay.
There is no problem of breaking global symmetry. All right, guys. So if I want to compute scalar potential, right, all I have to do is just look only at the fields in my model which have scalar terms, right? In the case of a chiral superfield, so there are two terms here. There will be phi I of x, right? And then there will be an f term, right? So those are the two that contain scalar fields. The rest will contain fermions. In the case of e to the v, right, so again, I do computation in the Vezzumino gauge. So I have a vector potential. I don't care about it. I look just at what the scalar potential will be in this SUSY QCD. And then I have a wild fermion, a gaugino, but I don't care about them as well. And so the only one that I have is a theta term. And so the theta term will enter like this. Now, once I understood that this is an approximation I can make, evaluation of all the Grassmann integrals is very simple. And so if I concentrate only on those terms, so I will get a part of Lagrangian, which takes this form dA,
So here I'm, I contracted the adjoint indices. And then there is another term, which is 1/2, which is 1/2 phi I bar dA trace in some representation phi I, right? So so the terms, so this term will come, so here this term will come from a Keller potential, right? In particular from this piece in the Keller potential. And so here when I write down the matrices, so the index R sub I means that my scalar fields, right, which are components of the chiral superfield, transform in the representation R sub I. So I have an appropriate, so in the case of the quarks, this would be 3x3 matrices, but I could consider some other representation, say a dimension 6 representation. So naturally, I would find a representation of the Lie algebra in terms of 6x6 matrices and so on. So this term will come up from phi I e to the v phi I. And again, you can evaluate it just by restricting to this set. And then there is the term which is quadratic in D terms. And so this guy will come from a superpotential for the supersymmetric field strength. Okay. And I actually believe that I lost the Young-Mills coupling there, but that's okay. So I have to write down proportional here. So there is an overall 1 over G Young-Mills squared, something like that. So, so in particular, there will be no derivative terms for dA, and so dA is an auxiliary field, and so I can eliminate it using classical equations of motion, and so the piece of the Lagrangian where d enters is just given there, and so when I solve for that, so I will find out the dA equals minus 1/2 phi I bar the generators phi I. And so if I substitute it back in this term, so the piece that will be left will be precisely a square of this term with 1/2. And so the piece of the Lagrangian that will be left is going to be minus, okay? And so here I will have 1/2 minus a square of this guy. So minus 1/2 minus 1/2 pi I bar square. And then much like in the case of a nonlinear sigma model, there will be an F term. Okay, so these guys are the same as my D's, and so the scalar potential will be equal to 1/2 dA, right, plus Fi squared. And so the conditions for having a supersymmetric vacuum are exactly the same as in the models with a U1 gauge symmetry. So namely, we have to have a vanishing of D terms as well as F terms. So Susi vacua, so in order for us to have Susi vacua, I need to have dA equal to 0. And F sub I equal to 0. All right, guys. So let's forget about supersymmetry again. And let's go back to ordinary quantum gauge series. So now what we discuss are quantum gauge series. So what I would like to talk today, do you guys have something after? Okay, so 5 minutes. Okay, let me at least explain. Let me at least explain the issues of scaling the generators, and then we'll be done. So what we'll discuss beta function. So we'll understand how the coupling changes, and then we'll talk about theta angles, and instantons. So most of this should be done definitely next lecture if we are to have any chance. I want to start next week's cyber-Fulton model. And finally, we'll talk about anomalies. Okay? So I'm just going to start with a simplest, well, it's not simple. It's still horribly complicated. But we're going to look at a pure glue theory, okay? Meaning that whatever we evaluated before, the supersymmetric Lagrangian, I'll just choose part of it which has gauge field in it. So if I do that, so I will find out that my Lagrangian takes this form. So I have minus 1 over 4 g and mil squared. And then I have sum over A, F mu nu A. F mu nu A. So A is the index that runs in the adjoint representation. So this is a familiar piece. And then there is a theta term. So this theta term will arise in exactly the same manner how it appeared in U1 theories as well. And it comes with a very specific normalization. And that normalization is actually related to the normalization how I normalized coupling and theta parameter in my complexified gauge coupling here. And then I have F A lambda rho epsilon mu nu lambda rho. All right, so very good. So the field strength F mu nu A, right? So it's related to a vector potential in this manner, minus del nu A mu A. So now, normally, that's all what we would have had. However, in the case of non-abelian gauge group, there will be a commutator in the definition of the field strength. And so this commutator will lead to a term which is quadratic in vector potential. Okay? And so this FABC are the structure constants that we discussed before. Okay, so let me write down them. TA TB equals I FABC times TC. So if we look at the model of this type, so those T's, they are generators, right? So they are generators, and remember that we introduce them in such a way so that we can write down a finite element of our non-abelian gauge group as e to the minus some parameters, right, times the generators in the appropriate representation, right? So if I use a generator in some representation R, I will get a finite element of my group written in this representation. And so in particular, those are just parameters. And so you can see that, strictly speaking, the way how I define my generators is slightly ambiguous. So I can scale them. By an arbitrary constant, right? And I will still get an element of of the group, and it will be exactly the same element if I scale appropriately my parameters, right? So let's formalize it a little bit, and this will allow us to write down this Lagrangian in a slightly better form, sort of a form which is invariant, which is independent. How do we normalize these generators? Well, so there is a symmetry. If I say that my generators are rescaled, go to T prime, which is alpha times T. So alpha is a constant, right? So this is a constant. So this will be an exact symmetry of my theory. If along with this rescaling, I'm just gonna rescale my structure constant in this way. It's really obvious symmetry, and I'm gonna rescale my vector potential as well, 1/(alpha A), and so the field strength is also gonna be rescaled, AV, so 1/(alpha F). Now, what we want to do, we want to our Lagrangian being once we do this arbitrary scaling, we want to keep gauge coupling fixed, right? So ultimately, the couplings are something physical, something that we can measure in scattering experiments. And so the only way how we can compensate for that is if we modify the trace, right? So we will say that, well, first of all, when we have a generators of our Lie algebra in some representation, so there will be a canonical symbol here, but there is an arbitrary constant, okay, in this representation. So this is known in group theory. This is a quadratic Casimir, right? Okay, and here I have trace in some representation. So for example, if I talk about quarks which are in 6 representation of SU3, then that would be a trace in the representation where my T's are 6 by 6 matrices. And so what I can do, I can completely restore, the invariance of the Lagrangian by requiring that my Casimir, transforms in this manner. So there is alpha squared. And so once I do that, right, then I can write down that Lagrangian in a manner that will involve just traces. Okay, so I take this form, Lagrangian -1/G Young Mill square, and then I will have a trace. So I have to specify a representation in which I do the trace, and that's, if you wish, a choice, a sort of conventional normalization of Casimirs. So with 16 pi squared, so here I have trace F, F tilde. And so a conventional normalization is a trace in the fundamental representation. So if I talk about the SUN gauge group, so a quadratic Casimir, so this will be in a fundamental representation. So this will be a quadratic Casimir in a fundamental representation times delta AB. And for SUN, C sub F equals to 1/2. So this is just conventions. All right, guys, and this F tilde is what we defined before, is a Hodge dual. So mu nu equals 1/2 epsilon mu nu lambda rho, F lambda rho. All right, good. So I'm done with all the definitions. And so next time we'll talk about beta functions, instantons, and we have to finish with anomalies as well. All right, guys, see you next week.